the good deeds that we're doing, he has the ability to reward us. There's no reason why he can't, right? So there's no reason why we shouldn't. This should help us in the performance of good deeds. When we constantly remember this fact, it can help us in the performance of good deeds and the relinquishment of bad deeds. اعمل عمل رجل يعلم أنه مأخوذ بالإجرام مجزي بالإحسان. This is the actual wording of the hadith. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at good actions in the words of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hussain Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
This one lay. Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
The Israeli military has assassinated Ibrahim al-Nablusi in Nablus. He was the commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. Just days ago, Israel assassinated two leaders of the Islamic Jihad movement and bombed the Gaza Strip in what was described as a preemptive operation. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why there has been such Israeli assassinations of Palestinian leaders and fighters in a short spate of time, while Israel continues committing raids, which has led to numerous injuries and arrests.
Israeli forces have assassinated Ibrahim al-Nablusi, a resistance fighter and commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Israeli troops raided Nablus early Tuesday and surrounded a building in the old city where al-Nablusi had barricaded himself in. A gunfight lasted for several hours with Israeli forces even firing anti-tank missiles at the building. 32-year-old Islam Sabouh and 16-year-old teen Hussein Jamal Taha were also killed in the raid. At least 60 Palestinians were wounded, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry.
We have not witnessed such an aggressive raid to Nablus in years. The aim was to assassinate al-Nablusi and any other Palestinian who was assisting him. He refused to surrender and clashed with the soldiers for hours and was finally martyred.
As the raid started, we rushed to the old town, but the soldiers had blocked the neighborhood. They opened fire at us. We tried to evacuate the wounded, including a woman, but they continued shooting at us. Dozens were wounded as a result.
Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid has reacted to Nablus operation, saying that the killing of whom he described as terrorist Ibrahim Nablusi was another step in Israel's uncompromising fight against terrorism.
This cell has been warring Israeli military. They carried out a number of shooting against Israeli soldiers and settlers. That is why the Israeli military wanted to strike them and kill one of its leaders.
A number of West Bank cities, including Ramallah and Al-Khalil, observed commercial strikes as part of a period of mourning and in protest at the killings in Nablus. The regime forces clashed with the protesters in Al-Khalil and shot dead at least one Palestinian.
It has become clear that Israel is targeting any Palestinian who is honored as a real fighter. The regime might succeed in assassinating those fighters like Ibrahim al-Nablusi, but they would even be remembered as heroes and icons who devoted their lives to fighting Israeli soldiers. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Hafsakara Mustafa joins us. She is a journalist and Middle East expert who joins us from London. Also joining us is Yusuf El-Halouk, political analyst, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Yusuf Al-Halu, I'm going to start with you and get a reaction from you in what has occurred, where you have the assassination in Nablus of Al-Nabulsi, commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, and also Hossein Jamal Taha, both senior members of resistance groups. It was a somewhat of a major operation in the way that they took both of them out. What is your impression of what Israel has done there in Nablus?
Well, I think this is a continuation of Israel's systematic policy of provoking Palestinian resistance groups, whether it's in Gaza or the West Bank. I think this is a clear message to all Palestinian resistance factions, not only Islamic Jihad, but also Fatah movement, the secular party that has been ruling the West Bank for the past 25, 30 years. I think Israel at will, it can invade, it can storm the houses of Palestinians day or night. It can kill, arrest, injure, maim. This is it clearly because Israel enjoys a culture of impunity, and the stance, obviously, of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank is somehow, weak when it comes to condemning Israeli attacks or to put an end. Obviously, the Palestinians, they don't accept this kind of occupation to go on. The resistance hands in the West Bank are tied. The support for the resistance is high among the Palestinian population, but when it comes to the official protection, it's absent. So that's why Israel can invade, create excuses to say that it wants to arrest or kill this wanted person. If we look at what happened in Gaza, obviously it was unprovoked attack. To assassinate members of Islamic Jihad movement. And this applies to other resistance activities across the occupied Palestinian territories. So Israel does not need a justification or an excuse to attack or kill. Israel enjoys this.
Well, that is the thrust of my next question, Hafsa Kara Mustafa. The official statement, as it was tweeted by the Israeli forces, said Palestinian terrorists Ibrahim al-Nabulsi was suspected, underline that word, suspected of carrying out shooting attacks on civilians and Israeli soldiers in the Nablus area. Prior to that, when you had the Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip, which lasted for 3 days, Israel said that they carried out a preemptive operation, which ended up in the death of these two Islamic Jihad fighters, along with obviously the rest of the civilian population that got killed, up to, I'm not too sure, it was over 40 or 50 at this point, an operation they carried out where they suspected the leaders perhaps to carry out what they thought was an operation. So just based on something that hasn't happened, Israel goes out and assassinates, in this case in point, senior leaders of these resistance groups. That's the focus of my question to you as to why that is acceptable to them.
But it is acceptable to them only because they can get away with it. Essentially, it is always down to Israel's impunity. I mean, this is the definition of behaving outside the rule of law, in illegality. You do not execute anybody because you merely suspect them. Under any form of regime, there is some form of court of law, some sort of process to determine whether somebody is guilty of any crime or not. And this is coming from the country that the West is trying to sell to its public opinion as the only democracy in the Middle East. Of course, it's not. We know it's not. It's a terrorist entity that actually relies on murder and massacres and mass slaughter to continue. And it does that routinely, A, to show the Palestinians that it can, that it needs to keep them under their authority, And then, of course, it's a reminder to neighboring countries as well that it can get away with it, because, of course, there's going to be no condemnation whatsoever from Western nations which support Israel regardless. So not only does Israel enjoy impunity, but it knows there's going to be no consequences. And again, of course, it has, with the recent relation, the warming of relationship with some Arab states, this has even emboldened them again, because there has been no consequence to their criminal action over and over again. If anything, now, more recently, they're even rewarded for their criminality. So why stop there, essentially?
Yusuf El Hulu, did you want to say something?
No, I was shaking my head. I agree with the guest. Obviously, Palestinians are squeezed into the corner. They are being crushed by Israel's military power. Israel uses the Palestinians are testing the ground, whether it's the West Bank or Gaza, to train its soldiers. It thinks that Palestinian blood is cheap, because obviously we haven't seen any of Israeli officials was ever held accountable to this. That's why it's got the green light from the Biden administration. The international community does nothing to stop this situation. And obviously, Palestinians have to accept it. This is what Israel thinks.
Well, we've talked about this green light and the fact that you don't have condemnation coming. And Hafsa Qaira Mustafa, one of the things that's really amazing about the way that this works out, this green light approach, is the way that the U.S. and EU actually did that when it came to the assault by Israel on the Gaza Strip. And this is the common rhetoric that they relay, urging all sides to avoid further escalation, but then they say they absolutely fully support Israel's right to defend itself. So isn't that the green light, which in turn means a code, go ahead, keep bombing Gaza?
It's a bit like if you're seeing two people fighting in the street and then you tell them, please stop, but then you hand over somebody an arm and say, listen, please stop, but then you're still handing them a weapon. So this is essentially what they're doing. And obviously the two sides are in no way equal, because on the one hand, you have one that has a very sophisticated and well-funded army, and the other side doesn't. It merely has some form of weaponry that it manages to smuggle in very difficultly in order to carry out some form of guerrilla warfare, which again is in its right and entrenched in international law in order to resist occupation. So I think the absolute chutzpah that we're seeing coming from Western powers is repulsive, but not surprising, because it's precisely this attitude that allows Israel to get away with it. And we've seen over and over again, and I think the context, the international context, is always important, because whenever there is news that actually take over public opinion, such as the war in Ukraine, such as the collapse of cost of living in many Western countries, you will see that the Israelis use that, because opinion is distracted elsewhere, and they make a point of actually carrying out these massacres and these raids and these operations, punitive operations, to punish the Palestinians and remind them essentially that they're completely isolated, that they have no recourse, no option other than to just support and bear what the Israelis are inflicting on them. So yes, it is absolutely repulsive, but it's not surprising. Unfortunately, it's going to also have many consequences on the international stage, because we're now seeing the complete erosion of international law in anywhere across the country. And I think overall, over the next few years, we're going to see some form of consequences of this attitude from many countries.
Well, the consequences come in many different shapes and forms. We're looking at a possible intifada were it to take place. But Yusuf El Hulu, please give us an introspective as to what you think has occurred, where you have Israel come out in a matter of just a short span of time, within a week, you know, target the Islamic Jihad leaders over in the Gaza Strip, and then over you have these leaders over in Nablus. It's a rather short period of time for them to go after these targeted assassinations. What do you make of that?
Yes, well, it's pre-planned. The current ruling party in Israel, led by Yair Lapid, I think he wants to appease the public opinion in Israel and to attract more voters in the upcoming elections. And it has been the norm that Palestinians are the scapegoat. Palestinian blood is the only way for Israeli officials to gain more votes in any elections in Israel's history. It was unprovoked attack by assassinating Taysir Jabri, the commander in Islamic Jihad movement in Gaza, and then another official, and the rest have been civilians mainly. I think it's to do with gaining a credit to the Israeli officials at the current government, and also to deepen the geographical separation between Gaza and the West Bank, and also to deepen the split between Hamas and Islamic Jihad, because Israel said it clearly that they are only attacking Islamic Jihad, and they did not attack any Hamas facilities, or they did not attack any Hamas member. So this clearly succeeded in putting this separation between the two large political parties and military groups in Gaza, and also it wants to divide Gaza from the West Bank. It didn't want the West Bankers to revolt or took to the streets. It didn't want the Gazans to react to what's going on in Nablus. And also it's to do with the silence of the international community. We call it the hypocrisy of the international community, the international conspiracy of silence. The world is busy. Nations are tackling different things. But we know that the morale and the consciousness of the Arab world, the Islamic world, is very high. But unfortunately, governments are tied in the hands of, obviously they will never agree to open their borders to come and liberate Palestine, because obviously there are agreements, and Israel has been using Gaza to scare other nations, whether it's in Lebanon or in Gaza. So Gaza has been always the weakest link.
Okay. Well, it's quite ironic what Yair Lapid has said, Hafsatkarah Mustafa, which was highlighted by Russia. And this is when he was not the PM. And he talked about Ukraine, saying intentionally, I'm quoting him, harming a civilian population is a war crime, and I strongly condemn it. A tweet back from April, of which Russia highlighted, and basically accusing Russia of war crimes, alleged bombing that happened that was that had Russia as being the one that executed it. Obviously, your reaction to that, how he shows disregard and contempt for Palestinian lives with that type of statement.
Absolutely, and I think, I'm taking back my fellow panelists was saying that Palestinian blood is cheap, and not just Palestinian, essentially. I mean, Muslim blood and Middle Eastern blood in general, we've noticed, whether it's Palestine, of course, or whether it's Afghanistan, phrases like collateral damage and everything have been mentioned so many times by Western leaders, by Western media, and we can see the distinction. As you recall, with Ukraine, they were opposed to the idea that fellow blonde, blue-eyed Westerners could be victims of war, as opposed to the fact that brown people, darker-skinned people, were absolutely okay with being bombed to smithereens by either Israeli or American bombs. So this idea that non-Israeli or non-Western blood is acceptable, it can be spilled absolutely with complete disregard, is common and is fiercely entrenched in the minds of many people in Israeli opinion and in Western public opinion as well. And I think this is the major problem, because as long as there is this us and them attitude, the way that they're dehumanizing the population of Palestine or elsewhere, this is the kind of attitude that allows this to happen. And I think that, you know, when we're seeing, when they feel the brunt of the wars and the consequences, that's when Westerners start reacting. But actually, as long as they see this happening very far away, and they dehumanize the victims in such a way to the point where they don't even regard them as fellow humans being killed, then these kinds of attitude become completely normalized. And this is the racist attitude that is fundamental basis of the state of Israel.
Indeed. Yusuf, hello. I don't know if you... Go ahead, Yusuf.
Can you ask the question? It wasn't me.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yusuf, I don't know if you saw the funeral procession for Nablusi and Nabu. I covered it live, and I saw also images coming through on Twitter afterwards when I was reviewing material for this program. And it was quite big. It was a large procession. And Israel actually, Israeli forces, from what I understand, had actually targeted some of the people there in the procession. Some attributed to the fact that there was gunfire coming from the Palestinians who were mourning into the air. So that alarmed the Israeli forces. But it was kind of reminiscent of the funeral procession for Shirin Abu Akleh. In terms of it wasn't as big, but it was pretty large. My question to you is, do you think, given the fact that you have so many Palestinians that came out, and you have these instances, that, in this case in point, happening so close to each other, that perhaps Palestinians are reaching that boiling point, reaching the precipice, that they're ready to do something? Because we're seeing so many different instances. Not that it doesn't happen on a daily basis, but so close to each other.
Well, Palestinians are really frustrated under decades of military occupation, roadblocks, checkpoints, donor arrests, campaigns, and so on. They cannot take it anymore. So they stand side by side, shoulder by shoulder, to show solidarity and sympathy with the families of those who lost their sons, beloved ones. And also, at the end of the day, Israel controls what goes in, what gets out of the occupied Palestinian territories. And the numbers that marched today or in the past few days, it shows that Palestinians, they have still got the steadfastness, they still got the spirit to show their objection to the Israeli occupation. I mean, any teenager Israeli soldier just can open fire and kill and does things without accountability. So the persecution is, it's unacceptable anymore. Young people cannot take it anymore. Israel thinks by the latest technology, by making life harsh and hard, people will forget about resisting, will forget about their homeland. But this did not happen, and it will not happen. And this is a proof to Israel that whatever it does, Palestinians basically simply will not give up until their lands are liberated.
This resolve is something that needs to, obviously, number one, be applauded. But I'm going to take one of the instances of an online tweet that I need to ask you, Hafsakara Mustafa, and get your reaction to, of which it said, "What does a ceasefire mean? As long as the occupation of Palestine continues, the siege of Gaza continues, and Israel is allowed to bomb our children to pieces every election season." Your reaction to that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, none of the agreements that Israel has sort of claims to abide by has actually been respected. And I think this is the perverse nature of how they're controlling this narrative. They are not going in for massive long-term operations. These short-burst operations are exactly designed to keep the Palestinian people constantly weakened without being able to properly organize. And the thing is, if it was a long-term conflict, then people could actually organize and could be more structured. But what happens is these small bouts mean that the civilian population, every time it stops, it sort of takes a deep breath and thanks God that everything has stopped, that the bombing raids have stopped, and some form of normality returns. And this is how this sort of perverse nature of the operations are carried out, because what the Israelis are doing is they sort of leave the Palestinians a bit of rest, and then they come back every 6 months, every 8 months, every 2 years, just to remind them who is actually in charge. And this is torture, essentially. If you put a prisoner inside a cell and you would give him some regular beatings or some regularly deprived him of food or things like that, but then fed him again, he'd be constantly in search of that moment of peace. And this is how the Palestinian people are kept in check. Sadly, this very, very disturbing, very perverse form of occupation is stopping any mass movement from being organized and actually finally tackling the Israelis in a proper way. Of course, it's going to be very difficult, and I think the only option would be some sort of long-term guerrilla warfare, but because of the nature of the conflict, mm-hmm. this is why it's not being possible, and this is how the Israelis are controlling the narrative at the moment.
Thank you so much for that. We're unfortunately fresh out of time. Hafsakara Mustafa, journalist and Middle East expert, with her contribution from London. Thank you so much. And Yusuf Al-Halu, glad to see you, political analyst from London. Thank you so much. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Takwe and the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is A to Z, an introduction into Husseini lifestyle. Today's lesson, the blessed bath of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Thank you for joining, everyone. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. And on today's lesson, we are going to talk about the blessed birth of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. Before anything, let me wish and send my sincere condolences for the arrival of the month of Muharram and for the arrival of the anniversary of the martyrdom of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. Now, in today's lesson, we are talking about the blessed birth of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. Under this, I would like to talk about the dream of one of the main women in the history of the birth of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. And I'm going to talk about the dream of Umm al-Fadl. Lady Umm al-Fadl was the daughter of Harith. She had a strange dream and she did not have any idea about its interpretation. Thus, she came to the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and asked His Eminence. She said to the Prophet, "I had a very strange dream that a piece of your flesh fell into my lap." Now, the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam dispelled her fears and gave her good news, saying, You have seen something good. If that's the dream that you've seen, then you have seen something good. Allah willing, or according to Allah's willing, Fatima alayhi salam will give birth to a boy that shall be given in your arms. The Holy Prophet told Lady Umm al-Fadl. Now, days passed swiftly and Fatima alayhi salam, the chief of the ladies, gave birth to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And the newborn child was given in the lap of Umm al-Fadl, just as the Messenger of Allah had informed Lady Umm al-Fadl, according to her dream. Now, the Holy Prophet remained waiting for the rise of the newborn star as the life of his beloved child was being illuminated by it. He was his favorite grandchild and the most beloved of those whom he left behind.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Welcome back. You are listening to A to Z from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. And on today's lesson, we are talking about the birth of Al-Imam Al-Hussein, the blessed birth of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. And in this topic, we are talking of how Imam Al-Hussein came into this world. We were just talking about the dream of Lady Umm al-Fadl alayhi salam, the dream that the Prophet explained very well, because the Lady Umm al-Fadl dreamt of something that she thought was bad. She had a very strange dream that a piece of the Prophet's flesh fell into her lap, and the Prophet told her, you need to have no worries. Whatever is happening according to the dream you told me is that this is good news. There's going to be a son who is going to be born from the progeny of Fatima alayhi salam, who is going to be called Al-Hussein alayhi salam. Now, the blessed birth of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam is something that the Prophet had already explained. The Prophet had already talked about before the coming of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. The chief of the ladies of the world gave birth to such a great child that no daughter of Eve had ever done either before the time of prophethood, nor after him. You know, he was the one who reached such heights of greatness that no one bestowed greater blessings or grace on humanity more than him. We are talking about someone who the Prophet talked about even before his coming. We are talking about someone the Prophet explained about before him being brought to this world. Thus, there was none purer or cleaner. We could say that there is none who is purer or cleaner and more prominent than Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. So the world became illuminated with him and the whole humanity at large, along with its whole progeny, because blessed became Muslims were proud of him and were considered his remembrance worthy, and every year they expressed their love to him. This is Al-Imam Hussein alayhi salam. This is how prominent he was. This was how good his bath was. Thank you so much for listening. Until next episode, fi amanillah, wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode and another lesson, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Better friends than you, but anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. A deep silence, feel the air.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference on the dire situation of Yemeni children amid the years-long Saudi war on the country. The ministry has criticized the United Nations for its inaction on Saudi atrocities.
When the United Nations removed Saudi Arabia from the list of violators of children's rights, it encouraged the kingdom to continue killing Yemeni children and targeting service facilities for children such as schools, hospitals and health centers. It also prevented the entry of humanitarian and medical aid for children. We know that there are UN reports that talk about the spread of malnutrition amongst children, along with many chronic diseases that need care. But unfortunately, there is no real action to save the children of Yemen.
Officials say the UN has collaborated with the Saudi led coalition in killing Yemeni children by providing political cover up for Riyadh's violations. Moreover, the world body removed the kingdom from the list of groups accused of violating children's rights.
The United Nations is a clear and prominent partner in the aggressive war on Yemen, and we have in the 8 years of war clear evidence that the United Nations participated in all the crimes committed against the Yemenis and did not condemn Saudi Arabia for its crimes, but rather the victims bear everything the executioner does. The United Nations has contributed to the killing of Yemeni children through its silence and coverage of Saudi crimes. It has also removed Saudi Arabia 5 times from the list of violators of children's rights.
According to human rights groups, more than 9,000 children have been killed or maimed by Saudi airstrikes since the beginning of the war in 2015. Health officials say more than 1 million children are suffering from malnutrition, one of the highest numbers in the world.
Human rights activists say the United Nations is hostage to Saudi Arabia's funding for its programs. They say the world body has contributed to the killing of Yemeni children because of its silence on Saudi crimes. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
Israeli forces have assassinated Ibrahim al-Nablusi, a resistance fighter and commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Israeli troops raided Nablus early Tuesday and surrounded a building in the old city where al-Nablusi had barricaded himself in. A gunfight lasted for several hours with Israeli forces even firing anti-tank missiles at the building. 32-year-old Islam Sabouh and 16-year-old teen Hussein Jamal Taha were also killed in the raid. At least 60 Palestinians were wounded, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry.
We have not witnessed such an aggressive raid to Nablus in years. The aim was to assassinate al-Nablusi and any other Palestinian who was assisting him. He refused to surrender and clashed with the soldiers for hours and was finally martyred.
As the raid started, we rushed to the old town, but the soldiers had blocked the neighborhood. They opened fire at us. We tried to evacuate the wounded, including a woman, but they continued shooting at us. Dozens were wounded as a result.
Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid has reacted to Nablus operation, saying that the killing of whom he described as terrorist Ibrahim Nablusi was another step in Israel's uncompromising fight against terrorism.
This cell has been worrying Israeli military. They carried out a number of shooting against Israeli soldiers and settlers. That is why the Israeli military wanted to strike them and kill one of its leaders.
A number of West Bank cities, including Ramallah and Al-Khalil, observed commercial strikes as part of a period of mourning and in protest at the killings in Nablus. The regime forces clashed with the protesters in Al-Khalil and shot dead at least one Palestinian. It has become clear that Israel is targeting any Palestinian who is honored as a real fighter. The regime might succeed in assassinating those fighters like Ibrahim al-Nablusi, but they would even be remembered as heroes and icons who devoted their lives to fighting Israeli soldiers. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
We never cease to support our Palestinian brothers and sisters. Why are the world rights entities keeping mum while Israel continues to kill innocent people in Gaza?
Tensions have escalated between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups since Friday, when Israel carried out airstrikes on cities across the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, killing dozens of people, including 2 commanders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement. The Islamic Jihad's military wing, the Al-Quds Brigades, responded by firing hundreds of rockets towards Israel, putting the Israeli forces on the back foot. Activists here say the Islamic Jihad's show of force has pushed Tel Aviv into calling for a ceasefire, which took effect on Sunday.
In the past, the Israeli attacks on Palestinians would go unanswered. But today, as soon as Israel carries out a strike, the resistance responds immediately with its rockets. So, the era of hit and run is over.
The conflict is the worst outbreak of violence between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups since Operation Sword Al-Quds, an 11-day war last May. The UN Security Council has expressed deep concern over the situation in the Gaza Strip during an emergency meeting held on Tuesday to discuss the Israeli aggression on the besieged territory.
While the UN has expressed its concern over the escalating violence against Palestinians, activists here say this is not enough. They called on the international body to stop paying lip service and take action to keep Israel from further violation of security in the occupied Palestinian territories. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Yemenis from all walks of life flocked to the street of Yemen's capital Sana'a to commemorate the third Imam of Shia Muslims, Imam Hussein. He was martyred on Ashura, the 10th day of the lunar month of Muharram.
We went out as Yemenis to commemorate the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, who inspired patience and steadfastness in us in the face of the forces of global arrogance. We are in a battle with thousands of people like Yazid and even worse than him, including America and Israel. They attacked the Yemenis people and the Palestinian people. They are still killing our women and children. So this memory gives us hope that the values we learned from Imam Hussein will make us live generously and win at the end of the battle.
Imam Hussein, protesters said, is still alive because of his immortalized values and beliefs, which reject the oppression and corruption that Yemenis are currently experiencing. They further said Imam Hussein was the symbol of revolution and tenacity who motivated Yemenis to resist the Saudi-led attack on their country.
This day is very important to us as we consider Ashura part of our identity. We are with Imam Hussein with our souls. Ashura this year coincides with the battle with the Zionist enemy, so the nation will follow the path of Imam Hussein in his jihad until the liberation of all occupied lands, especially occupied Al-Quds, and Yemen has come a long way towards freedom and independence.
After refusing to pledge alliance to the tyrant of the day, Yazid, in 680 AD, Imam Hussein and 72 of his companions and family members were killed during the Battle of Karbala.
People, he believed that Yemen has become a modern-day Karbala, with the Saudi-led coalition killing people, displacing civilians, and enforcing a siege on the country. People, he are confident that Yemen's fight against the enemy will ultimately lead to victory. Abdul Latif Roshali, Sana'a.
Like every other Muslim nation in the world, Afghans marked the 10-day mourning ceremonies for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his companions. Tasua, which falls on the 9th of Muharram and is devoted to Imam Hussein's half-brother, Abul Fazl al-Abbas, drew hundreds of mourners to one of Kabul's old shrines. Attendees listened to clerics' speeches regarding the Battle of Karbala and beat on their chests.
This year, we are marking Muharram rituals under the rule of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. However, our processions are more crowded, passionate, and prosperous than previous ones. You know that Muharram is not only related to Shias, so we have our Sunni brothers taking part in ceremonies and services shoulder to shoulder with Shias.
We Afghan girls share the grief of Karbala tragedies with Zainab, Imam Ali's daughter. We are all sorrowful on this day and remember the suffering and bravery of our role model, Hazrat Zainab. Today, we live under the flag and our hijab shows that we are her firm followers.
On Ashura, Afghan Muslims shut their businesses and take a day off to pay tribute to Karbala martyrs. They say prayers and hold charity events. This year, despite security threats, they took part in mass mourning ceremonies alongside Taliban officials.
Today is the martyrdom anniversary of great and respected Islamic figure and grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. I offer my condolences to you and all Muslims. Undoubtedly, Imam Hussein sacrificed his life to save Islam. We, the people of Afghanistan, followed Imam Hussein's path through fighting against invasion, arrogance, and oppression. May Allah keep the love of Imam Hussein alive in the hearts of all of us.
Ashura is significantly important in Islamic calendar. Ashura and Imam Hussein's school of thought teaches freedom, bravery, resistance, and Islamic unity. This righteous path will last until doomsday. We Muslims globally are obliged to announce and spread the message of Ashura to all Muslim and non-Muslim people, especially youths.
The commemoration comes as Shia Afghans have been repeatedly targeted in places of worship and schools by terrorist groups, only because of their ethnicity and beliefs. On the 7th and 8th of Muharram this year, two bomb explosions killed and injured more than 30 Shia mourners. Afghanistan has witnessed different social and political changes over the course of centuries. Against the odds, Shia Muslims have been steadfast in remembering the Battle of Karbala and Imam Hussein's martyrdom. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Hundreds of mourners march through various streets wearing black and reciting elegies in honor of Imam Hussein, who, along with dozens of his household members and loyal companions, were martyred in Karbala in present-day Iraq.
The marchers here said this is a time for sorrow and self-reflection when one commits himself completely to the mourning. They said the mourning and the reflection of the tragic events at Karbala are intended to connect to the suffering and martyrdom of Imam Hussein.
This very day, marked 10th of Muharram, is the day of sadness, is the day of agony, is the day of shedding tears to all Muslims. And the reason is that in the field of Karbala, Imam Hussein was being mercilessly killed by Umayyad leaders.
The mourners also engaged in chest beating as the procession moved around the town in the hot tropical sun. The mourners said Ashura not only signifies intense grief for Imam Hussein, but is also a motivation for resistance against injustice in the world.
Imam Hussein has submitted his life entirely in order to save Islam. And that is what Malin Ibrahim Zakzaki Hafizahullah is calling for, that the entire Muslim and even non-Muslim, even Christian, let us gather together to fight oppressors, let humanity and then justice be in our nation.
Many of the mourners said they will continue this struggle to resist injustice because, as the well-known phrase goes, every day is Ashura and every land is Karbala. Ranjum Abdullahi, Suleja.
Throngs of Londoners marching through the center of the British capital to commemorate Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, brutally murdered in the Battle of Karbala 1,400 years ago. Similar processions in the rest of the UK and the world to mourn him and his 72 companions killed along with him, among them members of his family. Their crime, standing up to the tyrant of the time, the Caliph Yazid.
It was a tragic incident that happened many years ago, but the moral stand that Imam Hussein took has transcended time and space. Its reverberations felt through generations, and this is proof of it.
Many generations later, men, women, and children flagellate themselves to identify with the suffering of the Prophet's grandson, a man of morals who strived for social justice.
Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam represents all of the martyrs in all the world throughout human history and planetary geography.
For me, he represents justice, bravery, and sacrifice.
His story is an example to mankind. As he stood against oppression and injustices.
And it's not just the mourning that unites the people here. For them, the march is an annual chance to share the legacy of Imam Hussein beyond the borders of their countries of origin. Saeed Purza, London.
Mourners in Karachi commemorated the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein's youngest child, who was not spared by the enemy forces.
The 6-month-old Ali Asghar, the youngest son of Imam Hussein, was martyred by the forces of Yazid. The Battle of Karbala and Imam Hussein's sacrifices for righteousness and freedom are still a source of inspiration for Muslims around the world.
Mothers who brought their babies along paid tribute to Ali Asghar on the first Friday of the Islamic month of Muharram and mourned the 6-month-old son of Imam Hussein.
What had the 6-month-old done? We are out on the streets recalling the message of that innocent child of Imam Hussein, that we will always stand against the tyrant of the time. We will always stand shoulder to shoulder with the oppressed, no matter what.
Special eulogies and rituals were performed to commemorate the incident where Ali Asghar was killed with an arrow shot in his throat in the plains of the Iraqi city of Karbala.
We are commemorating the martyrdom anniversary of Ali Asghar, the youngest martyr of Karbala, who teaches us the lessons of readiness and sacrifice in the face of injustice and brutality.
Ali Asghar was martyred while he was in the arms of his father Imam Hussain, who was pleading for water to quench the thirst of his little baby. The grandson of Prophet Muhammad and his companions sacrificed their lives but refused to pledge allegiance to the unjust Umayyad Caliph Yazid. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
Prayers, storytelling and tearful rhythmic chanting are all expected when Shia Muslims begin their annual Muharram commemorations across the globe. Shia Muslims mourn the first 10 days of the Islamic month of Muharram, remembrance of the martyrdom of the Prophet Muhammad's grandson Imam Hussein, who was unjustly slain by an oppressive tyrant some 1,400 years ago.
It isn't only in the East that you witness the mass commemoration of Imam Hussein's legacy, but also a growing community in the West, particularly of Shia Muslim converts, are benefiting tremendously from the story of Imam Hussein.
We spoke to one convert who explained to us why he felt Shia Islam was the ideal faith for him.
That's what I did like about the following of the Ahlul Bayt, because I could see in the condition of black people in the past, we suffered quite a lot. In the past, when you look at the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, it's there too, that they see people suffering and they didn't like it in their time. And similarly, when we reflect on Hussein and our lives today, we've got to think Hussein didn't like that we mistreated and not respected as a human being. So it's important that we emulate what he stood for.
Despite the growth, some community leaders feel more work is needed to be done to support new converts. Shia Muslims currently make up about 15% of the estimated 3 million Muslims in Britain, with well over 100 mosques across the nation. Ensuring Imam Hussein's memory is being shared like never before. Robert Carter, London.
On Tuesday, thousands of Lebanese marked Ashura, the martyrdom anniversary of Prophet Muhammad's grandson and the third Shia Imam, Imam Hussein. One of the most pivotal speeches of Hezbollah Secretary General is usually given on this day. This year was no exception. Addressing hundreds of mourners in Beirut, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah outlined main stances of the resistance movement.
Today, on the Day of the Oppressed, our message to our enemy is that they need to know who they are facing and that in Lebanon there is a resistance that has proven that it can defeat the army, which was said to be invincible, and it is ready to go to new heights.
Sayyid Nasrallah warned that Hezbollah will not sit idly by if Israel carries out its threats to assassinate leaders of the Palestinian resistance groups in Lebanon.
We tell the enemy, do not miscalculate your moves against Lebanon or the people of Lebanon or the resistance in Lebanon, not on the issue of petrol or gas or maritime demarcation, and do not make the mistake of launching any assault. In the last few days, we heard that they are plotting to assassinate figures from Islamic Jihad or Hamas or other Palestinian factions in Lebanon. On Ashura, I tell them that any assault against any person in Lebanon will not go unpunished.
The Hezbollah leaders stress that the movement will take action based on the response that Beirut will get from Israel on the issue of maritime resources. Nasrallah said Hezbollah will by no means compromise on Lebanon's rights. Muslims across Lebanon hold mourning processions for 10 days in Muharram to remember the horrific crimes which were committed against the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, Imam Hussein, and his family and companions in the plains of Karbala in modern-day Iraq in 680 AD. This historic tragedy remains very much alive in the hearts and minds of the mourners to this day.
Imam Hussein was killed more than 1,000 years ago, but he is still alive in our hearts today, and he is our leader in this fight against Israel and Americans' aggressions.
The injustice happening around the world, the oppression that's going on, everything has been linked to what Imam Hussein suffered with his family 1,400 years ago, because the message that has conveyed in Karbala is conveying nowadays, because as we know, every day is Ashura and every land is Karbala, and that's what we say in Arabic.
The Lebanese mourners also hoisted Palestinian flags along with black and red banners of mourning to show that the day of Ashura is the day where the oppressed fight back.
The Ashura commemoration for Hezbollah and its supporters goes beyond the obvious religious rituals. It has defined their stance in the face of U.S.-Israeli policies, not only as a military resistance, but also as a deeply rooted political and social movement. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
In the limelight.
Yet again, Gaza and its besieged population are brutally used as pawns in the Israeli regime political game. Sadly, as the world turns its back, this latest deadly episode won't be the last, says Khaled Al-Haroub, writer, in an article published under the heading, Zionist regime's wars on Gaza are now just a routine part of its politics. Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime's latest aggression against the Gaza Strip caused the death of 45 Palestinian civilians, including 15 children, a total power cut, and the destruction of dozens of homes and buildings. The attack was part of the Zionist regime's routine practice of mowing the grass, a term that refers to reducing the military capabilities of the Palestinian resistance factions. Translating this into a military operation, the Israeli regime began the aggression on August 5th by assassinating Taysir al-Jabari, one of the leaders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, then declared that its objectives were to destroy the military bases and capabilities belonging to the movement. Beyond these standard claims lies political opportunism and internal Israeli election considerations. Militarily and strategically, this round of aggression is part of an Israeli regime attempt to split the united front of Palestinian resistance factions. The war, ironically but also typically, was carried out without any serious international objection or criticism, camouflaged smartly by the so-called efforts of mediation led by Egypt to achieve a ceasefire. The repeated scenario of using Gaza and its besieged population as cards on the Israeli regime political and election table is just as scandalous in itself and in how the world keeps tolerating it. If a shaky Israeli regime or a prime minister fears upcoming elections, the shortcut option to strengthen their position in the eyes of voters is to attack Gaza. The pretext is a ready-made claim of protecting the security of Israelis. No matter how much Palestinian blood is shed, how many innocent people are killed or injured, and the scale of destruction inflicted, the show goes on. In this last aggression, where the world turned its back on Gaza, in the name of attack, Operation Breaking Dawn reflected one thing the current Bennett-Lapid coalition cabinet hoped to secure, a new dawn in power. Otherwise, there was no breaking of any dawn at the larger scale of things. Within a wider strategy, Israeli regime generals have been attempting since Operation Black Belt on Gaza in November 2019 to split the Palestinian resistance front. As no official criticism came from Cairo in response to Israeli deception, questions were raised over whether or not Egypt was informed by the Zionist regime about its planned strike. Egypt looks like a crucial pacifier during and after each Israeli regime war on Gaza Strip. But in light of the little benefit